45. 11:16 a.m., November 15, 2018, University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois. Hand in hand, Matilda and Ashanique ran across the campus. While Matilda worried they looked too obvious running through the crowds of students and patients, no one stopped them. No one really even batted an eye. Truth was, Matilda thought most people avoided drama at all costs. Too much hassle. Too much worry. Good thing a surging panic pushed Matilda on. She was amazed she wasn't winded. She had never been much for running. Swimming was always her thing. Matilda found being submersed was not only relaxing, it was also restorative. In water, sound traveled differently. Light bended and warped, and her mind shifted into another gear. One she hadn't known existed until she started doing all her heavy thinking underwater. Meter by meter, kick by kick, she could scroll through her research. Isolated in the pool, complex chemistry made more sense. Swimming, she could synthesize peptides and catalyze enzymes with ease. It even had the benefit of being healthy. According to her personal physician, it was the best low-impact activity she could do to strengthen her heart and oxygenate her brain. But on land, scrambling across campus, dodging past students, she was weaker than she expected. The air was heavier, the ground that much harder.
"You okay?"
Matilda yelled to Ashanique as they rounded a building. Ashanique grunted a yes. Matilda could feel the girl holding back. She assumed Janice must have trained her to run, to escape and survive. Ashanique could shoot. She certainly could sprint.
"Breathe in and breathe out. Keep the time. Match the crunch of your feet on the sidewalk with the thump of your heart."
A minute later, they cleared the corner of the bookstore and stepped out onto South Ellis Avenue, where a passing cop car slowed down. The cruiser's lights were on. The bulky cop behind the wheel leaned his head out the window.
"Everything okay?"
"There's a man," Matilda began. "He's chasing us. He has a gun."
The officer got out of his car with his hand on his gun.
"Go on. Get inside."
As they ran around the cruiser and climbed into the back seat, he reached in through the open driver's side window and grabbed his radio.
"Car 12 to control."
A woman's voice came over the radio.
"Go ahead. 4 Adam 16 on scene at university. Possible 1032 OR.
"Control to 12, I read you. Possible 1032. What is your location?"
The cop looked back at a street sign.
"On campus, South Ellis, near the intersection with East 58th Street. I don't have a visual. Got 2 females, 1 white, 1 black, a preteen in my car. Says there's a man after them. No visual. Over."
"Stand by."
The officer got back into the patrol car and hung up the radio before he closed the door. He turned around to Matilda. His name tag read, "Gomez."
"You two all right?"
"I think so,"
Matilda said, barely controlling the panic in her voice. She didn't feel safe, even in the back of the cop car. She wasn't sure she'd ever feel safe again.
"He's in the hospital. If you haven't gotten the calls already, they're going to be coming in fast.
It's the same guy from the university a day ago. The same man."
Before Matilda could go on, the officer turned to the front. He pulled his cell phone from his shirt pocket and flipped it open. He dialed a 3-digit number.
"I have the girl," he said into his cell.
Matilda stopped breathing.
"Understood," Officer Gomez said.
He hung up his cell with a sigh. Matilda put an arm across Ashanique as the cop turned around with his gun. The only thing separating them was the mesh partition and 3 feet of human air.
"You went for my weapon," Officer Gomez said. "I had to defend myself."
"No!"
A jagged sound split the air as something smashed into Officer Gomez's forehead. The gun dropped from his hand as he slumped against the steering wheel. Ashanique lowered the Colt onto her lap.
"He was going to kill us."
Stunned, Matilda silently glanced through the mesh at Officer Gomez's body. The morning had left her mind scrambled. Her world was not so much turned upside down as it was turned inside out. She had been right after all. She wasn't even safe in the back of a cop car.
There is no safe place now. Tomiko told you as much, Maddie. They will come for Ashanik, for you. They control everything and everyone.
We have to get out of the car, Ashanik said. Matilda?
Matilda felt like screaming.
We have to get out of the car.
The doors were locked, so Ashanik lay back and kicked at the left rear passenger window until it shattered. She toppled the loose glass and then reached gingerly through the frame to open the door. With a click, it swung wide. Ashanik pulled Matilda out after her.
We have to leave now, Matilda. We can't call anyone. No police. There's no one we can trust. We have to find a place. They're not going to be looking for us. A place to hide out until tonight.
Matilda thought immediately of her mother. It wasn't so much that she considered Stony Brook necessarily a safe place, or that she always turned to her mother in times of deep confusion and stress. It was concern. She had to warn the facility. She had to get her mother to a protected place, locked away until this was over. Somewhere out of town. Somewhere they could all hide. Truthfully, she didn't consider the ramifications. She only knew what she'd seen, and she knew she never wanted to see that again. Her overriding instinct was clear. Go to your mother. Make sure she's safe.
I know a place, Matilda said.
They flagged down a cab on East 59th Street and barreled into the back seat. 3 blocks away, cop cars, their lights blazing and sirens rending the air, charged onto campus. The cab driver, the ID posted on the plexiglass partition, gave his name as Jasper Adeyanju, turned around, and asked where he was supposed to be going. Matilda said,
Braidwood, Stony Brook Assisted Living Facility. It's on South LaGrange. I-80's probably fastest.
Okay, it's your money.
Jasper started the meter and turned up his music, a rollicking Nigerian highlife pop song, before easing the cab into traffic. In the back seat, Ashanik lay back and sighed. Matilda saw tears welling up in the corners of her eyes.
It's okay. You just saved our lives.
I haven't killed anyone before, Ashanik whispered.
Not in this life. You did the right thing.
Ashanik turned away, wiping her eyes.
That's not it. There is no right thing, no wrong. There are only actions and repercussions. And all the bad things, all the cruel consequences come from fear. Maybe that cop was scared. Maybe that's why he was about to kill you. I'm not sad about him losing his life, though. He made that choice.
Matilda didn't know what to say. She nodded, trying to be sympathetic.
Are you afraid, Matilda?
Unsure of how to answer, Matilda took a moment. She saw Raid cutting Clark's throat. She saw his blood splash onto the floor. She saw the cop's head being blown open. She saw again the horror in his eyes.
Yes, Maddie. You're afraid. Very afraid.
Don't be, Ashanik said. I know the secret now.
46. 11:38 a.m., November 15, 2018. I-90. Chicago, Illinois. Wandering the aisles of the gas station, Ashanik picked up a bag of salt and vinegar potato chips, a package of strawberry licorice, and a root beer soda. She met Matilda at the checkout counter. Matilda paid cash for the food, 2 touristy baseball caps, 2 cheap pairs of sunglasses, a pair of kitchen scissors, and 2 prepaid smartphones. Walking back out to the cab, Matilda pulled the SIM card from her cell, the one she'd had for 2 years, filled with undownloaded pictures of Clark, before she tossed the phone into a trash can. She handed the SIM card to Ashanik. The girl bent it before it snapped in half. We have to be smarter from now on, like my mom taught me, Ashanik said, dropping the pieces of the SIM. No credit cards, no logging into accounts. We're going to have to look different, too. Cut our hair and change our clothes. The cab took I-90 out of the city. The sun was hidden by churning clouds that turned the humid air a sickly yellow. As the cab idled in traffic, Matilda took Ashanik's hands. They were cold, but not shaking. Not like her own.
Everything that is happening, Ashanik said. It was because of an experiment. That's why I'm like this. Why I can remember other lives.
You were in this experiment?
No, but my mother was.
Ashanik glanced up at the rearview mirror and caught the cab driver's eyes beneath the bill of his cap. He immediately looked away.
It was in the late 1970s in Alaska.
And you saw what they did there to your mother?
Ashanik nodded. There were 50 children, all of them orphans. Some taken from hospitals, others from orphanages. A few of them snatched right off the street by the night doctors, or so they were called. The night doctor's name was a boogeyman thing. Rumors swirled around, you know? People in poor neighborhoods were scared. Kids had gone missing.
The traffic cleared, and the cab sped up.
That's how they got their name. But the thing is, the night doctors aren't maniacs. They're scientists. Smart people who got caught up in something so complicated and so important that they can't see how destructive it is. Matilda, if you want to understand this, you're going to have to forget what you think you know.
About what, Ashanik?
About everything.
Ashanik turned and looked out the window at the quickly darkening world. The sun had vanished. The shadows were so long, they swallowed whole buildings. For a second, the world looked like it was being erased.
Why do you care about me?
She asked.
I made a promise to your mother that I'd keep you safe, Matilda said.
And I, well, you're amazing for starters. I've never met anyone like you. And, well, actually, that's not true.
A few years ago, I saw a patient who said a lot of the same things you've said. This man came to me because he was worried. He knew he wasn't ill, not in the clinical sense, but he didn't know how else to handle the things he was seeing in his head. He came to me for help, and he opened up. This patient told me something I couldn't believe at the time. I was blind and stupid, and I let him down. I'm not going to do that again.
Did he remember past lives?
Yes, he did.
He was the man I saw the picture of in your office, right?
Yes.
His name was Theo, Matilda said. And he talked about the night doctors.
He talked about being taken by them into a lab.
About being experimented on. They call us the Null, Ashanik said.
The Null?
One of the doctors, I think it was Dr. Kadri, said it as a joke. She said that if we weren't careful, we'd become the Null hypothesis. The Null thing stuck. What she really meant was that we were a side effect. Project Clarity wasn't about making people like me. We were the mistakes, the insignificant, the Null.
If you were the mistakes, were there any successes?
Ashanik couldn't staunch the tears welling up. Her mind was changing so quickly. With every new memory that appeared, it felt as though new neural networks had been formed. Synaptic connections that had lain dormant since birth suddenly thrummed with electrochemical life. Neural hormones that had drifted aimlessly in the intracerebral space found themselves drawn, like iron shavings, to the magnetic pull of newly awakened nerve cells. The feeling was like a neural thunderstorm. Every burst of synaptic energy, a bolt of lightning. And with each new image came a new emotion. Even the slightest recollection added to the density of her thoughts. Ashanik could feel her thinking transform, even when she spoke to herself in that eternally quiet voice. The words were different. She used bigger words, crafted more complicated sentences. The past was colonizing her, gifting her with its boundless store of knowledge.
Successes. When I hear that word, I want to picture people breaking the tape at the end of a marathon. I want to see people smiling and laughing. Instead, I see the blank stare of the brain-dead boy, his spinal cerebral fluid leaking from his ears.
I'm sorry, Ashanik. I'm so sorry you have to feel all that. Having to experience all those things firsthand
must be so difficult. No one should have to witness so much suffering.
Beauty,
Ashanik said, wiping the tears away.
What?
Ashanik took Matilda's hands in her own and squeezed them tight.
What they did was horrible. The successes were the worst. But what the Null discovered, what we became, is beautiful. It's difficult to put into words. But when you see your past lives, when you see down the chain of genetics through all those people, all those experiences, you realize something profound.
Matilda couldn't look away. Ashanik needed her to hear this.
We are forever, Matilda. We think it ends the minute our eyes close and our heart stops, but it doesn't. There isn't heaven. Not like they say, but we do live on. I see all the way back. All that history. All that knowledge. It's right in front of us the whole time.
47. 12:42 p.m., November 15, 2018. Stony Brook Assisted Living Facility, Braidwood, Illinois. As Matilda signed in, Ashanik made her way into the foyer, where Rosa was watching TV and Francine sorted through another stack of National Geographic magazines. The receptionist in scrubs smiled at Matilda.
Your mother's in the memory care unit's sitting room, she said. I'd like to check her out for a few hours. She doing okay today?
The receptionist made the come see, come saw hand gesture. She got confused at breakfast.
Do you know anything about a hairpin?
She thinks her neighbor might have taken it.
The hairpin's with my uncle. I explained this to her nurse.
Sorry, the receptionist said. I'll make a note of it in her chart.
I think the nurse already did.
Anyway, it might not be a great day to take her out.
You guys going to lunch, or?
Let me put in a call to Dr. Chaudhry. He and you can talk about how she's doing. I'm just saying it might not be the best day to have her out.
He'll call us back, and then I'll patch the call through to the memory unit, and you can talk to him there.
Matilda met Ashanik by the muted TV. The receptionist waited for the call, scrolling through her social media feeds. The TV was tuned to CNN and continuous coverage of the second university shooting. Matilda didn't think it was a good idea for Ashanik to be watching it. But then, a photo of Tomiko popped up. She was smiling in her lab coat. And the scrawl on the bottom of the screen read, "Noted professor found dead in laboratory. Suspect still."
"Terrible thing," Rosa said.
Francine shook her head as she flipped through the January 1988 issue. After 30 seconds of digging around the couch, Matilda found the TV remote and changed the channel to a Law & Order rerun. She took hold of Ashanik's hand and led her toward the back of the facility.
"Come on. I want you to meet my mother."
After the receptionist punched in the code to unlock the door to the memory unit, Ashanik followed Matilda inside. They took a wide hallway to a sitting room as the door clicked shut behind them. Lucy was in a rocking chair, rocking slowly, staring outside at the empty bench where several Stony Brook employees took personal calls and smoked. She was cradling a well-worn baby doll. Matilda leaned down beside Lucy and placed a hand on her shoulder.
"Mom?"
Lucy turned and examined Matilda's face.
"Hello,"
she said.
"Do you know what time it is? I feel like I've probably been wasting most of the day just looking out the window and daydreaming."
"Did you know I was a college professor?"
"Yes, at Colgate."
"Oh," Lucy said.
"We met before? I'm so sorry."
"Mom,"
Matilda said,
"we need to go out for a bit, okay?
We're going somewhere?"
"Yes, just for a little bit."
Lucy looked around Matilda at Ashanik.
"Who is that?"
"This is Ashanik."
Lucy looked Ashanik over and nodded, more to herself than Matilda.
"Yes, Yes. I've met her before. She comes regularly to visit her grandmother. This is my first time here,
Ashanik said. Lucy screwed up her face, confused.
No. I've met you before. I think... No. You were a student. Yes. You were one of my very best students.
Do you remember the lesson? We have a test today. I hope you came prepared.
Mom, Matilda began, we have to start packing. Lucy waved her off,
then smiling to herself, contently ensconced in the memory of a long-ago lecture, she started speaking in French.
Qui est au Sénégal? Ils ont vendu les esclaves au pot. On emballe aujourd'hui à voix basse. Mais ça se passe.
Curious, Ashanik pulled a stool over from under the window and sat across from Lucy. She leaned in and listened carefully as Lucy mumbled. Matilda watched, impressed with how gentle Ashanik was, but unsure of what the girl was doing. It's okay, Matilda said. She has these moments. It'll pass. Ashanik touched Lucy's knee.
J'étais autrefois unique beau. Qu'est-ce que vous avez dit?
Lucy asked.
J'ai été volé de mon peuple.
Ashanik continued.
J'étais sur un très long voyage à travers l'océan. J'étais au bord de l'Henriette Marie.
Lucy gasped.
Il a coulé dans une tempête.
Matilda hadn't studied French in 15 years. She was in shambles when she tried to speak with any fluency, but she could still read the language. She got the gist of what Ashanik and Lucy were talking about. Lucy was fully absorbed in the conversation. Matilda had not seen her mother that focused, that attentive, in nearly a decade. She couldn't help but cover her mouth as she watched the two of them converse. Lucy with her flourishing hand gestures in wide amazement, and Ashanik with a knowing, nearly wise modulation and tone.
This is miraculous. I am witnessing the miraculous.
But as miraculous as it was, they had to get moving. Matilda knew it was only a matter of time before the people coming for Ashanik tracked them to Stony Brook. She'd taken a huge risk coming to the facility, but it wasn't until she'd watched her mother conversing with Ashanik that she truly realized the enormity of what she was doing.
Why didn't I just check us into a hotel? Or go to the bus station? Because you're human, you're flawed.
Where do people turn when they're in trouble? Where do they always eventually run? Home. They always go home, Maddie. And home for you is your mother. Now get her the fuck out of this place. Matilda stood up, interrupting the conversation. I need you to get her stuffed pack, okay? We should leave soon.
She's coming with us? Isn't that...
Ashanik asked. We'll drop her with a friend on her way out of town. Ashanik turned and looked toward the entrance to the memory unit. She was listening for something. Matilda only heard the sound a few seconds later. She made no mental connections to the noise. She didn't associate it with anything more than the usual sounds of daily life. A car backfiring, a balloon popping, someone clapping. But then she heard the screaming, and she knew.
He was here.
48. 12:53 p.m., November 15, 2018, Stony Brook Assisted Living Facility, Braidwood, Illinois. Raid was struck by the smell when he stepped into Stony Brook. He stood by the receptionist desk and inhaled, long and slow, catching the scent of something nostalgic. But there were no real memories associated with the chemical lavender smell of the facility. It was what bubbled up from underneath. The paradoxically clean smell of a clinical death. To Raid, this was a place where malfunctioning people went to spend their last years, their bodies being slowly dragged into the abyss by the weight of their crumbling minds. This was the end of all tethered flesh. The place stood as a stark reminder of just how much more he is than the average person. He wondered momentarily about others like him. Surely there must have been at least a handful. How did they die here? Were their brilliant pure selves entombed in an animal grave? The concrete shoes of flesh? How horrible.
Excuse me.
Raid turned to the receptionist as she removed her headphones. If you're here to visit a resident, I'll need you to sign in and I'll have to see your ID.
Deacon.
As a matter of habit, the receptionist stood to walk around her desk and take Raid's ID. She paused midway. She looked beyond him, outside the front doors. She knew she'd noticed something lying just outside. A coat and shoes. Maybe she'd even felt the tickle crawling up her spine, spilling over her shoulders, as she realized she was looking at a body. That was when she saw the blood. The receptionist spun around, her mouth open in a silent scream. Raid's first round hit her neck. It severed her headphone wires first, punching a nasty hole in her carotid. She hit the floor, bleeding out. Reaching over her desk, Raid grabbed her ID badge. Her name was Becky.
What was that? I heard.
An elderly man tottered around the corner, waving his cane. Raid shot the man in the gut. He stepped over the body and walked into the TV room, where an older woman turned to glare at him.
Where is Dr. Deacon?
Raid asked. The woman was too terrified to speak. The words just wouldn't form in her gaping mouth. Next to her, another woman, oblivious to everything as she turned the pages of the November 1990 issue of National Geographic, paused to fix her hearing aid. Deaf as an adder, she turned to page 32 of the magazine.
You know that murder I told you about?
She asked loudly.
Well, this is going to sound a little bit like I'm cuckoo in the cuckoo head, but I don't think I actually did read about it after all, as crazy as it seems.
Raid killed Rosa and Francine with two shots each. Then he walked to the memory unit and studied the keypad. Some of the keys were darker than others. He knew that was from their finger grease. No one usually notices that kind of thing. On this keypad, the 3, 6, 9, 0 were the darkest. Raid stood there staring at the numbers, working through the various combinations in his mind, when he was interrupted by the arrival of two police officers.
Drop the weapon!
Raid stood still, the gun tight in his right hand.
I said, drop the fucking gun!
Raid turned slowly, glancing over his shoulder at the cops. The first officer commanded again.
Drop the gun, asshole!
Raid wasn't going to comply. He moved, faster than either officer expected. Raid's first bullet hit one of the cops in the left leg. As she fell, the second officer fired. That slug slammed into Raid's right side, shattering his 10th rib before exiting through his back. Briefly spun by the force of the impact, Raid recovered. Sharpened by pain, he returned fire with deadly accuracy. The second officer was hit first. The bullet entered his chin, passed up through his tongue, and lodged itself behind his eyes. Before the first officer, now on the ground, could get off another round, Raid shot her in the neck. She crumbled, pressing her hand against her vertebral artery to staunch a pulsing gush of blood. Pushing his left hand flat against his wound, Raid walked over to the cop. She tried to speak, tried to plead. He shot her in the head. 49. 12:59 p.m., November 15, 2018. Stony Brook Assisted Living Facility, Memory Unit, Braidwood, Illinois.
Mom, we've got to go.
Why now?
Lucy asked, reaching for Ashanique.
We're talking.
Mom.
The shriek of alarms answered, and a sound obliterated the normal hum of the memory unit. The residents began to panic. Nursing staff and medical staff ran to calm them and organize them for evacuation. An old man with a prosthetic leg stumbled over a stool. A woman in a wheelchair held her hands over her ears and screamed. The door to the memory unit opened, and Raid stepped inside. Matilda stood frozen. Again she saw Clark's throat being slashed. Raid's murderous wink replayed in slow motion. Ashanik grabbed Matilda's hand tight. The sensation snapped Matilda from her paralysis, and she turned and took Lucy's arm. She and Ashanik ran with Lucy toward the back of the unit. Down a long, twisted hallway, lined with framed photos, Lucy cried and muttered. She told Matilda that her arms were being hurt, that she was being bruised. Matilda wanted to cry, to apologize, but if she even said one word, she knew it would slow them down. Raid was likely only yards behind them.
If you don't run, you'll all die.
As they passed her bedroom, Lucy wrenched free of Matilda's grip and ducked inside. She slammed the door behind her and quickly locked it.
Don't come in, Lucy shouted from the other side. I don't know who you are, but I don't want you to come in. Mom, it's me.
Matilda banged on the door with her fists. Even as her brain was going into paroxysms of anxiety, she clearly recalled when Lucy still lived at home and would accidentally lock herself in the bathroom. She'd cry, trying to get herself out. Matilda would calmly explain to her how to open the door. It never worked. Matilda would always have to use a knife to pick the lock and open the door. She'd find Lucy calmly sitting on the toilet, smiling like a child. Next time, sweetie, Lucy would say, please knock before you come in. But this time, Matilda knew she wouldn't get the door open, and she knew her mother couldn't be calmed on the other side.
Come on, Ashanik pulled at Matilda. Please! Mom!
Matilda slammed her body hard enough against the door that the wood cracked and splintered. She did it again and again. Still, the hinges held. Raid moved slower than he would have liked. It'd been a while since he was last shot. Each step he took, the broken bones ground together, and tiny slivers stuck deeper into his left lung. He could count at least 78 similar injuries over his lifetimes. In one of his bodies, he'd had his right hand severed by an enraged husband. In another, an arrow gouged out his left eye. When he was born again the next time, the injuries had healed, the flesh was intact. Ray tried not to think of the animal encounters. So many maulings, so many bears. Ray rounded the corner in time to see Ashanik point the Colt at him. She fired. The shot went wide, but he didn't flinch. I won't hurt you, Raid said. Doubting she could hear him over the screech of the alarms and the wailing of confused residents and terrified staff. Ashanik fired again just before Matilda dragged her clear of the hall, a framed painting of a bucolic farm, shattered, just over Raid's head.
Come on!
Matilda took Ashanik's hand, and together they ran toward the rear doors of the memory unit, the ones that led outside to the courtyard. But when they reached it, the door was locked. They were trapped. Sirens deafening. A strobe light flashed wickedly above their heads.
We have to get to the museum!
Ashanik struggled with the door, desperate.
How many rounds do you have left?
Matilda shouted over the noise.
I don't know, Ashanik said. Maybe five.
Matilda said,
use them all.
Raid appeared at the end of the hall. The reflective strips on the sides of his pants flashed in the strobe light. Despite his injury, he walked quickly. Ashanik fired the Colt, rocking her back into Matilda. A light fixture exploded over Raid's head.
I'm going to cut you apart, he said,
step quickening.
Just like your mother.
Ashanik began to cry as Matilda pushed hard against the door with her hip. She was able to glimpse daylight through a crack at the bottom of the door and tried to widen it with her foot. Kicking at it, the door seemed to loosen in its frame. Though it was unlikely that she'd get it open, Matilda had to believe she could.
Come on, Maddie. Push this fucking thing.
Behind Matilda, the Colt shook in Ashanik's hand. As now only 50 feet away, Raid raised his gun, his grip strong, his hand steady.
Put the gun down, girl, he said.
Please,
Ashanik begged through tears.
Please.
There was a sudden clang of metal before the door moved, and Matilda stumbled forward into the wan daylight. Pulling the door open, Kojo stepped inside, 9mm in hand. He moved in front of Ashanik and fired 5 rounds in quick succession at Raid. Raid in turn fired back as he wove and dodged.
Hurry!
Kojo shouted back to Matilda, but she was already outside with the girl, running to Kojo's idling car. 2 feet from the vehicle, a sobbing Ashanik faltered. Matilda caught her and helped her into the back seat. As soon as Ashanik was lying down, she began to seize.
It'll pass.
Matilda climbed in and held her.
It'll pass.
As she gritted her teeth, Ashanik said,
I don't want it to.
What?
These memories, they...
Ashanik passed out before Kojo barreled out of the building and climbed into the driver's seat, slamming and locking the door.
Hang tight.
Kojo slammed his foot on the gas pedal. The car lurched forward, nearly throwing Matilda to the floor.
That asshole must have been hopped up on something,
Kojo said, looking in the rear view to see if Raid had emerged from Stony Brook after them.
I hit him, no doubt about it. Didn't seem to slow him down any, though. I should go back in, make sure he doesn't kill.
We have to get her out of here,
Matilda said, holding the girl. Ashanik continued to seize in Matilda's arms. Glancing over his shoulder, Kojo asked if Ashanik was going to be okay.
Her doctor said she has seizures, he said. We need to get her to a hospital, right?
No hospitals, Matilda said. We can't trust anyone.
Ashanik doesn't look okay. She needs help.
She has help. Please, just get us downtown.
As Kojo radioed in the shooting, he pushed the car down a suburban street as fast as it would go, fishtailing around corners. In the back seat, Matilda pulled Ashanik closer. The girl's convulsions slowed, their violence diminished. But still, her eyes moved in frantic arcs under her eyelids. Matilda wondered what new nightmare she was seeing. 50. 7:28 a.m., October 15, 1979. Three Saints Bay, Kodiak Island, Alaska. Janelle is 11, and she follows her mother through deep snow. The sky is translucent, the no color of water. But the sun is nowhere to be seen. Janelle assumes it's hidden behind the towering fir trees that they're walking between. But every time she looks, she can't see it. They are both wearing snowsuits. The crunch of their boots is the only constant sound. They've been walking for nearly 20 minutes. A crow croaks somewhere closer to the mountains, and Janelle is glad to hear it. Dr. Song had explained to her that they're some of the smartest creatures besides people, dolphins, and apes. He'd pointed up at a tree that was filled with crows, a murder cawing in the dusk, and told her that they were social, just like people. Crows can remember faces and voices. They're always watching because they're infinitely curious. Janelle and her mother came to the edge of a rocky escarpment, and her mother stops. Below them, the waves crash against black, jagged rocks that look like giant's teeth. Janelle once called them the Nephilim's molars. The first time she saw them, she wondered how many ships had been chewed up there. Surely there were just heaps of old shipwrecks under the water. Janelle imagined scuba diving down there and picking through the wreckage. She'd find cannons and crown jewels, just like the explorers in the pages of National Geographic did. Her mother kisses her, bringing her out of her daydream.
None of this is going to make sense, she says. But if you survive what happens next, then you will be stronger than I ever was. Don't let them break you, okay? Promise me, you won't let them break you.
Janelle has no idea why her mother has taken her out into the snow. She doesn't understand what her mother is saying. Truly, none of it makes sense. Dr. Tyriel is exhausted. She's been sick to her stomach for 5 weeks straight. She hasn't slept in 3 days, and she's been seeing things. Not people or imaginary beings, but distortions, wavy lines and shifting ripples of light. She knows the problems are in her visual cortex. Lack of sleep and never-ending stress will do that. The visions are warning signs. It's her brain's way of putting the brakes on thinking. The brain's way of protecting itself. And Dr. Tyrael knows it'll only get worse. At this point, there is no way to stop it. Every passing minute, her body fights to pull her back into the lanes of sanity. Not now, though. Standing 200 feet above the raging ocean, the hallucinations have stopped. Maybe it's the fresh air. But her stomach is no longer trying to turn itself inside out. Her mind is clear. Her daughter will be just fine. She is strong enough. With that last certainty, she runs and jumps. She expects gravity to kick in quickly. Throw 142 pounds over the edge of a cliff, and it will fall fast. But there is a fraction of a second where Dr. Tyrael feels weightless, like maybe she will blow out across the sea. The sensation doesn't last. It's a trick, another of her mind's contortions. She plummets too fast to even cry out. She doesn't hit the water. Her body shatters against the rocks before it is caught up in the churning darkness. A single thought burns before her soul powers down. Coral. We are coral. For Janelle, it happens before she can even process it. Her mother is there, and then she is not. Janelle steps to the edge of the escarpment and looks down into the ocean. There is no sign of her mother. Janelle knows that they won't recover her body. Her mother did exist. She is certain of it. But outside of whatever few pictures remain, there is no evidence now. Janelle stands there staring, and the snow starts to fall. She is still there when the snow stops and the sun cuts through the clouds. It illuminates the faces of the men, soldiers from the base who crash through the forest and sweep Janelle up. One of them carries her like he'd carry a newborn. He says something about hypothermia, about how her lips are blue. Janelle tries to imagine what that looks like. Mostly, she pictures the women with funky makeup she saw in a fashion magazine once. She tries to laugh, but no sound exits her mouth. Back at the base, Dr. Song wraps her in warm blankets and plies her with hot tea. It's sweetened with a ton of honey, something her mother would never do. She'd only add milk and tell Janelle that was enough. Janelle doesn't want to think about outside, about the ocean and the molars that ground up her mother. She wants to be warm and sip tea. For the first time in a very long time, Janelle honestly thinks that people like her. Why else would they do all this? That's when it hits her. The other children, the damaged ones behind the numbered doors, don't ever feel this. Even though her mom and the other scientists explained it to her, saying that those children needed help, that they were sick, she knows that sick, damaged children need comfort too. Suddenly the tea she's sipping isn't sweet. The warm blankets feel like wet sheets. She kicks them off and puts the tea down. The numbered doors don't have windows. The experimental subjects can't see her. But Janelle feels terrible being in front of them like this, carrying on like she can't help herself, like she doesn't have free will. Though she came to the facility a visitor, she's become a patient, just like them, and her mom must have known. Janelle realizes that the stuff her mother was saying near the cliff about being strong, about not breaking, that was in preparation for this moment. Janelle realizes that she needs to be strong, not just to survive this place, but to ensure that what happens here never happens again. Janelle also knows that the comfort, the kindness, won't last. She will be next. Sometimes the universe makes everlasting decisions in the blindingly brief segments of time. In less than a fraction of a second, whole stars can evaporate, and massive black holes can come into existence. So it is with Janelle. In between heartbeats, she becomes the fighter she knows she'll need to be. Janelle doesn't have to wait long. She sleeps terribly that night, her dreams clotted with visions of her mother floating and falling, in a terrifying loop. And she wakes frequently as the scientists fight just around the corner.
They're arguing about where to go next, about how everything might be lost because Dr. Tyrael, the damned bitch, took the solution with her. With that, they may as well start from scratch with a new method. Though Janelle only hears bits and pieces, it is enough to convince her unconscious mind that she needs to leave. When they come for her, soldiers dragging her out of her sleeping bag at 2 in the morning, she is ready for them. She fights, her nails raking Morton's face. He howls and hits her hard in the stomach. Stuck gasping, she is dragged on her back down the hallway to the machine. Morton presses an old napkin from his pocket up against the angry scratches on his face. He flicks Janelle off while 2 soldiers hold her down, and Dr. Tomiko Kadri injects her with a stinging liquid that burns as it runs into her veins. Seconds later, Janelle goes woozy. Her brain turns to wool, and her body evaporates around her. Dr. Dorothy Sykes materializes. She stands over Janelle, hands clasped before her like she's going to ask a favor. Which is silly. She's in control here.
"You know what we do here," Dorothy says. "You know how important our work is. I need you to help us, Janelle. You can be a part of what your mother was trying to accomplish. You don't want to see all of her hard work, the work she lived for, go to waste, right?"
Janelle feels herself nod.
"This is a waste of time," Tomiko says. "We can pull the information."
"Pull it how?" Dorothy barks. Her voice softens as she addresses Janelle again.
"Good. That's excellent. Your mother, sad to say, left some unfinished business. She was working so hard. Maybe she just forgot to let us know how to continue her work. We need some numbers. Very, very important numbers. I need you to think back to every conversation you had with her. Every conversation you overheard, every note you might have seen, every paper of hers you might have colored on the back of. You're a smart girl, very clever. Do you think you can go back through all those memories?"
"Yes," Janelle said. It comes out as, "Yes."
"Good, good." Dorothy kneels down beside Janelle and strokes her hair. Dorothy's hands are too cold. They feel like icicles scraping across her scalp. "I need you to search your memory for numbers and letters, a formula like in chemistry, and it's associated with a complicated series of words that go in short palindromic repeats. Do you understand?"
"Yes, but I don't..."
"Don't what?"
"I don't have any memory of anything like that."
Tomiko stomps over.
"This is absurd. She won't remember this way. What if she is not one of them?"
Dorothy asks Tomiko.
"What then?"
Tomiko says,
"We make her one."
Dorothy glances over Janelle at the scientists on the other side of the room. They all look at one another uncertain before they nod. Tomiko looks closely at Janelle and says,
"She's healthy enough that we can increase the wavelength without doing much damage to the neurons. We give her an extended exposure, and we do it until we see the activity. Truth is, the mechanics of activation in the null cohort is unclear. Could be it's not a mutation. Could be it's just something natural that's been reactivated. Atavism, in a way. We all carry the DNA to have tails, but it's not activated. I honestly think we might be seeing some deeper process with the null. Some underlying memory system that most humans have either lost or possibly sublimated. If I'm right, and we can pinpoint the source of this archaic memory network, then we can not only reactivate it, but also alter how it functions. This might not be unique. With enough prodding, so to speak, we might be able to make anyone null."
Dorothy doesn't need to think it over. Get her ready. 15 minutes later, Janelle's head is shaved, and she's in one of the jumpsuits that all the experimental subjects wear. She's one of them now. As they wheel her to the Linux machine, she sees 2 of the soldiers spray painting the number 51 on an empty cell door. Her new home. Her head is still as light as helium, her body still stretched out and rubbery as chewing gum. In position beneath the machine, Janelle closes her eyes.
Dorothy gives the signal, and the Linux is turned on. There is an industrial thunderstorm overhead before. 51. 1:43 p.m., November 15, 2018, I-55, Bolingbrook, Illinois. Matilda picked up the colt from the floor of Kojo's car. Ashanik had fallen asleep in Matilda's arms, but it wasn't until the seizure had ended that she was able to ease the girl over onto the seat. Ashanik slept deeply, her head resting against the window. The cold glass was pressed up against her forehead. Matilda didn't want to move her. Ashanik needed every second of sleep. "I'm coming up to talk to you." Matilda climbed up into the front passenger seat and buckled in. She had the Colt in her right hand and tried to keep the gun leveled at Kojo, but her shaking hand belied her anxiety. "Holding a gun on a cop? Good move, Maddie." Kojo clearly saw the gun, but said nothing. He kept his hands at 2 and 11, eyes on the road. Surely Matilda assumed it wasn't the first time he'd had a weapon pointed at him. Still, it was a tremendous risk. "I need your cell phone," Matilda said.
"I've already called in the shooting," Kojo replied. "Your mom will be okay."
"You don't know that. Give me your cell, please."
Kojo pulled his cell from his coat pocket and handed it over to Matilda. She rolled down the window and tossed it outside.
"Seriously?"
he asked, slowing the car.
"Keep going," Matilda said.
She pulled out the second prepaid smartphone they'd bought at the gas station and handed it to Kojo.
"It's already activated."
"This is ridiculous," he said, looking over the phone.
"This is life and death."
"You know you don't need to keep that on me," Kojo said, eyeing the gun.
"I'm sorry. I can't trust anyone."
"I know you've gotten yourself mixed up in something ugly. I never said you wanted any of this, or any of it was your fault. But you're in it now. You should try to let me help you get out of it. Help you and her."
Matilda glanced back at Ashanik.
"Everyone who's tried to help us has also tried to kill us."
"I haven't," Kojo said.
"You haven't yet."
Matilda shifted her weight, uncomfortable in the seat. She felt beaten, scarred, existentially confused about everything that had happened. After Clark was murdered and the cops came onto the scene, she held out hope that her world could be righted again. She honestly believed that things could get back to normal, or some semblance of normal. All that evaporated the minute Raid showed up at Stony Brook. It was as Tomiko had warned. There was no escape, no safety. Matilda was determined just to survive the evening, long enough to get Ashanik to the museum and the mysterious Childers. Whatever happened after that would be out of Matilda's hands. Her job, her only job, was to ensure the girl got there.
"Let me take you two back to the station, Matilda. You'll be safe there. We can forget you put a gun on me. We can get her some help and figure out what's going on together.
I'm sure if we compare notes, we'll... It's getting late. We have to be downtown."
"The girl's clearly sick. She's got real problems."
"No, she's something more than us."
Kojo watched Matilda sidelong. He was struggling to stay on top of all the information being thrown at him. The day had begun with the confusion of the videotape, more than enough to keep his mind busy for weeks, before exploding into a bloody shootout. He had no idea what to expect next, but he couldn't stop himself from formulating new outs. Taking Matilda down, convincing her to let him take the girl to the hospital, or worse, overpowering her and getting the colt. He had time, the interstate was congested, and it would likely only be even more backed up as they got closer to the city. Kojo could sense Matilda was serious. It was the same sensation he'd had in the offices at the university during her questioning. She had a profound empathy, something inherent,
something integral to who she was. That was the deeper reading, the emotional brain. And yet, other deeper parts of him saw something else. Even with the exhaustion, even with the panic, she had an unidentifiable sexiness. He hated thinking the word, but it was true. Get your goddamn head back in the game. Two things that needed to happen. He needed to get that gun from Matilda, and he needed to convince her to trust him. He wasn't sure which would come first.
What's downtown? Kojo asked.
Matilda seemed to weigh the question carefully.
Museum, she said. It's the International Museum of Surgical Science.
And, before you ask,
no, I've never heard of it either.
It's on Lakeshore Drive, right by Burton.
There is someone she can trust there. Someone who will meet us.
You talked to Arsenic's mother, right? She kicked you out of the apartment when she found out you were interviewing the girl. What to read on her? Why is she dosing her daughter with cancer meds?
Matilda said, what's happening to Arsenic happened to Janice.
Kojo nodded. That seemed to make sense.
Janice was arrested 13 years ago, he said. She was swept up in a raid on a suspected drug lab. Feds have her linked to some terrorist group, targeting scientists and military officers who were part of a project.
The clarity, Matilda confirmed.
Crazy as it sounds, Arsenic has seen it, because her mother and her grandmother saw it. And I'm convinced that's real. Somehow, this Project Clarity unlocked memories, possibly even as a side effect of some larger experiment. And Arsenic has inherited her mother's predisposition for activating those ancestral memories. She's going to lose her mind if we don't get her to that museum and get her treated. Take a look at her, Detective. You saved our lives back then. You've seen what we're running from. Kojo glanced at the rearview mirror. Arsenic was breathing heavily, slowly. He had to admit, she looked worse than the last time he'd seen her. He turned back to Matilda.
What happens at the museum?
Arsenic's not the only one with this. I don't know how many there are, but Janice was in touch with a group.
The Null Cohort, Kojo said, putting it all together for himself.
There's an underground and a Dr. Song who can help them.
He can cure her?
Matilda said, I don't know.
Janice seemed to think so. Kojo thought it over, looking back at the girl again. Arsenic looked fragile. That tough, spirited instinct, that survival kick that had gotten her this far was clearly draining. Maybe Matilda was right. Maybe this was the result of some fucked-up experiment. But in the end, it didn't matter. What mattered was that there was a sick girl in his back seat. A girl who'd die without his help. Ignoring the procedural voice that droned in the back of his skull about rules and regulations, about job security and making his mortgage, Kojo knew what he had to do.
Okay, I'll take you.
He pulled a hand from the wheel.
I just need to get that cell you gave me. It's in my coat pocket right there. I have to call home to make sure my boy's okay, all right? He was expecting me.
Matilda thought it over.
I'm being real, Kojo said. No tricks.
Matilda motioned her okay with the gun. Kojo carefully pulled the cell from his front pocket. He called Ophelia, and as he waited for her to pick up, he looked over at Matilda. For the first time, he noticed that the hair on the underside of her ponytail was scarlet.
Mr. Omabo?
Ophelia answered the phone.
I'm going to be a little later than expected. Really sorry about this. I do have an appointment with my sister at 8.
Kojo turned to Matilda.
I will be home as soon as I can. Thank you, Ophelia.